Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. The International Latex Corporation was probably best known for the manufacturing of women's bras under the brand name Playtex in the 1950s and 60s. But there was a branch of the ILC that also worked on making the first spacesuits and eventually became the prime contractor for NASA, making the Apollo spacesuits designed to be worn during extravehicular activities, including for the 12 moonwalkers that donned the suits on Apollos 11, 12, and 14 through 17. They were handmade and custom fitted to each astronaut, and they had to be both protective and reasonably comfortable for the demanding tasks of working on the surface of the moon, where daylight temperatures are around 200 degrees Fahrenheit. The suits worked flawlessly, and joining us to talk about their history and development is Bill Airey. His new book, Lunar Outfitters, Making the Apollo Spacesuit, chronicles the story of the spacesuits through the eyes of both the engineers who designed and tested them and the women seamstresses who worked with custom sewing machines to hand-make each suit to exacting standards. Airey worked as a spacesuit test engineer and historian for the International Latex Corporation and has assisted the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in preserving the suits in their collections. He joined us recently from his home in Delaware to talk about the story of the suits that Neil Armstrong and his fellow moonwalkers, 12 in all, would wear on the moon from 1969 to 1972. Bill Airey, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you, Dave. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, when I got this book, I started to read it, and then I got so deeply involved in it after a while, and then I'd put it down and pick it up again, and I was thinking, this thing is just remarkable. This is such a great historical record of the manufacture of these spacesuits that were so integral to us going to the moon during the Apollo era. And it's almost like, you know, everybody working on spacesuits now, like for, say, the Artemis program, I would think they'd want this book on their shelves.
Well, yeah, I would think so. I wrote it for a lot of different reasons. But if you look at, part of my reasoning was thinking about who's going to read this was that anybody that's coming into the field trying to develop the current suits of the future, I would certainly want to know what the past was because, you know, you want to know where you were before and what drove the early designs. And so this book kind of contributes to that. It's not just the history, but it's not for just historians, but for people looking toward the future too.
I'd like to start out really asking you about your own story. How did you first come to work for International Latex Corporation, ILC, in Dover, Delaware? And tell us how you came to this.
Yeah, that's kind of one of those stories where you take that left turn. I was heading to college. I was going to go to the University of Delaware, and I think my major at the time was going to be psychology. I thought that would be fascinating, and I didn't have the money at the time, and I wanted to make a few bucks to get back to school, and I thought, well, if I find a job, I could start putting some money away, and a good friend of mine's father was working at ILC, and they had just wrapped up the Apollo program a few years before with the end of the Apollo-Soyuz test program there, in 75. So I came in 77 and knocked at the door. He said, come on down, fill out an application. And I did. And they had a couple openings because they were gearing back up again. They had just won the space shuttle suit contest. And so there was a real lull between 75 and 77. The company actually went down to like 25 core people, and that was all they had. And they were building back up again. So my job was to work in a production area for a little while. Then I worked on technical report writing. I did some of that. And then finally, there was an opening in the test lab. And by that point, the college thing, especially psychology, was a distant memory. I didn't even want to think about it. I was just enthralled with working at this company that had spacesuits hanging on racks in the back of the plant. And they were the old Apollo suits. And of course, I watched Neil Armstrong walk on the moon. So it was just fascinating. And I stayed there for 41 years.
Wow. And then how did you come to become kind of like their, I don't know if I should say it this way, de facto historian? Because, you know, I know that like when the National Air and Space Museum, they'll like send interns to investigate and learn about the history of the spacesuits at ILC there in Dover, Delaware. And you're like their guide. How did you become like this amazing historian for them?
Well, thanks for that compliment. It's interesting. I was young when I started there in 77. And so I started working with a lot of the folks that had just finished up Apollo. And so they were, you know, 15, 20 years older than myself. And I became good friends with them, including Homer Rehm, who became our company president. And as time went on, by the late 90s, I suppose, there was a University of Delaware had an exhibition going on for the Apollo program, for the Apollo 11 mission at that time. It was July 20th. They were going to do a little museum setup up there at the university and asked if I could help. Well, actually, Homer Rehm came to me, the president, and said, would you pull things together? Because he knew I was interested in, I would ask him a lot of questions about the program and the others that were there. And so he knew that I had the interest, and I was kind of the younger guy coming along. So I went up to the university and helped them work things out up there to put the display on. It was a really great display they had. And around the same time, I started working over at the Smithsonian, helping them out, putting together an outline of, you know, what they had in their inventory and what was a spacesuit. They were smart people, obviously, but beneath the outer layers of the suit, I don't think they really knew what was there. And they had an idea, but not in any great detail. So I was able to get a lot of that information and actually bring over some of the engineers that worked on the rubber dipping program there for the Apollo program. And they were just blown away by the fact that I was able to gather up the people who actually worked on it. And so I just got wrapped up in it. And as time's going on, of course, a lot of these Apollo folks have moved on. And sadly, a lot of them have passed away. And there really wasn't a month that would go by where we wouldn't get some calls from people around the world wanting to know about the spacesuits, the Apollo suits in particular. So the calls would come to me and I just kind of rolled with it. And I just felt that the story needed to be told because it was obvious to me no one was going to tell it. So that's how it all kind of happened.
Wow. And we'll get into the layers of the spacesuit and what's beneath those outer layers later, because that really is fascinating. And was fascinating to me as a kid learning about the spacesuits, but I learned so much more from your book. I'd like to know, can you give us kind of like an overview of what spacesuits were like from, say, Project Mercury in 1961 through 1963, you know, up through the Gemini program to the Apollo suits when you guys, you know, your corporation really started to take off and build these suits. Tell us about the state of the spacesuit up until then.
Yeah, sure. Well, the earlier suits, I really kind of, it's just my way of looking at it. I refer to them as pressure suits, not so much space suits, although they went into space. But, you know, the earlier suits, Mercury and Gemini, were derivatives of high altitude suits that the Air Force and Navy was using. And they were good suits. They would get the pilots down if they had a problem. They would get them down to a controllable flight level where they could, gain control of the aircraft and get it on the ground. So that's what Mercury was. Mercury was the B.F. Goodrich Mark IV suit, modified with the outer cover layer, and but not a whole lot of difference underneath. But good mobility. Of course, they weren't even really pressurized. The capsule was pressurized. So those suits were kind of just there in case they needed the pressure if they lost it on board. And the same with Gemini. The only difference with Gemini being they were David Clark suits, and they actually did do some extravehicular activity to learn how to do some of that outside of the spacecraft, because that was what Gemini was all about, is how do we get to the moon and work, do rendezvous and those things. And in an emergency, yeah, if you had to go out and do a spacewalk, could you do it? And those suits were, they were good suits at the time. The David Clark Gemini suit didn't have a lot of mobility when it was pressurized. It was a rather rigid suit. And NASA knew that, although they thought at the time there was they thought maybe they could use the Gemini suit with some modifications to make it a moon suit. But I still call them pressure suits. And while that was all going on, even from the Mercury program and as far back as to the early 1950s, Len Shepard, one of our early engineers at ILC, was really focused on making the first true working spacesuit, the one that could be used in space. In the 50s, he didn't know we'd be going to the moon. I think his vision was maybe something more along the lines of Gemini, just going outside and working. But he started developing that suit in the 50s. So by the time 65, 66 comes around, ILC was in a pretty good position to have a fully mobile suit, although it still needed some work. By no means was it the ideal suit, but it was probably further along than the Mercury or Gemini suits. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Well, let's talk about the Apollo program. which is near and dear to my heart. Let's talk about the first suits, the Apollo 1 suits that the astronauts were wearing during the terrible fire of January 1967, where Grissom, White, and Chaffee were killed during the test on the pad. Tell us about that suit and maybe lessons that were learned that evolved to the first suits that were flown on Apollo 7, for example.
Sure, sure. So, yeah, that was a tragic event. What happened was, as far as the suit development went, by 64, 65, NASA was getting a little worried about the suit development. It wasn't coming along very fast. And we were teamed up till early 65. We were teamed as a subcontract to Hamilton Standard. And it was really a struggle. The suits were really wide. They bulky. They didn't have the greatest mobility. There was just a lot of design problems. So NASA was worried, and they decided what they would do is do what was called a Block 1 and Block 2 program. The Block 1 would be the programs that would be pre-lunar landing. So up to, in this case, you know, Apollo 10, we would use a suit that wasn't necessarily a lunar walking suit. So NASA was okay with continuing the use of the David Clark suit through the Block 1 of Apollo. So they would maybe do some modifications to the Apollo or the David Clark suit, and maybe even have that as a competitor to as a lunar suit, because it'd give them a little time to develop it before the Apollo 11 landing. And so they were going to use the David Clark suits and then give us time to keep developing this Apollo lunar suit and call that the Block 2 suit. So in 65, we split from Hamilton. There was a new competition, and we ended up winning the contest again, and they made us a prime contractor. So that gave us a little time to develop this Block 2 suit. Well, lo and behold, the Apollo 1 training comes along with Grissom, White, and Chaffee that evening, and they get killed in the fire wearing the David Clark suit. It was the Block 1 suit. And it had a Nomex cover layer. There were many other issues, such as I think we're all familiar. A lot of us that are familiar with the program know that the capsule was pressurized with pure oxygen, that the capsule door opened inward. And so it all conspired to kill these astronauts. And so review boards met after that, and they looked at it and said, well, what do we have to do to get these astronauts out of a fire if that were to happen again? And obviously one of the things they had to do was take away this pressurized oxygen on the launch pad at sea level pressure, and also have the capsule door open out. And if you could provide a suit that could get them out of the fiery capsule in time, that would work. So they, at that point, the review boards concluded that it was not wise to continue funding the David Clark suit as a Block 1 suit, because so many radical designs needed to be made throughout the program. They decided to just focus all their attention on the ILC suit and call that the Apollo suit. And what it drove was the outer cover layer being switched from Nomex to a beta cloth, which sounds relatively easy, but it wasn't, because beta cloth was something new from Owens Corning. And we had to work with Owens Corning to develop this outer layer that would resist the flames in the capsule. And in NASA's studies, they looked at it and said, well, those astronauts with the capsule door opening out, reduced pressure of oxygen, if they had 50 seconds, about 45 to 50 seconds, they could get out of the capsule. So we just had to provide an outer cover layer that would do it. And that's what the beta cloth would do. So we integrated the beta cloth on the suit. And fortunately, there were no fires after that. But that's kind of the story about how that progressed. And then we used those Apollo suits all through the mission.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Bill Airy. His new book, Lunar Outfitters, Making the Apollo Spacesuit, is the story of how the suits were made for the first human exploration of the moon 50 years ago. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Stay with us. Thank you. we're back. If you're just joining us, our guest is Bill Airey. He's the author of the new book about the spacesuits the astronauts wore to explore the moon 50 years ago, titled Lunar Outfitters, Making the Apollo Spacesuit. Before we go any further, I should mention for our listeners, the ILC, a lot of people associated that corporation with the Playtex bra. And you know, it was always, you know, kind of fascinating to people that the company that makes these bras are the ones that are making the spacesuits to go to the moon.
That's right. Yeah, that's it's some kind of fight off and on. I there's been occasions where there's been some journalists there. There was Nicholas DeMoncho wrote a good book, Fashioning Apollo. He did a great job. He captured some of the people's stories. He goes off in a little different direction with his book, but he does focus heavily on the bra and girdle industry and the nuances of that. And it really wasn't that way. Our engineers didn't come from the bra and girdle side. They had a different vision of how spacesuits should be made. They were really forward thinkers. And if you think about, you know, the challenges of, and I wrote a book on it, so I couldn't tell you in this segment how, you know, go into the details. You'd have to read the book, but it's
yeah, of course,
to envision how a suit works. And so these at the time it was all men, you know, we have ladies now that work on the suit designs, but the men that did it back then in the 50s and 60s, they had a vision of how a spacesuit works. So they were really disjointed from the Playtex. They weren't connected in any way. However, when it came to the sewing, and I mentioned that heavily in the book,
yeah,
these suits were fabricated by seamstresses who, were in some cases homeschooled. Their mothers taught them. They learned something in school and home economics. But it was a learned trade. Some of them did come over from the Playtex side where they were doing bras and girdles and different development over there. And they would work with these engineers in developing the suits. So there was a sort of a connection, but I don't want people to think that there was some engineer that was working on bras and girdles and decided he'd go do a spacesuit because it wasn't that way.
Right, right. But
thanks for a neat story.
But the seamstresses, and I'd like to focus on them for a little bit here. They're amazing, the talent that these women had and their attention to detail. And you go into some wonderfully detailed stories, and you know, people should read the book, but I would like to mention a couple of them. Like, for example, tell us about some of the people you profile in your book, like Eleanor Foraker.
Yeah, Eleanor Foraker. And sadly, she passed on, as did a few of the others that I always like to talk about. Ellie was a real tough-as-nails character. She was like out of the movies. You know, she was just one of these people. You heard stories about her, and then when you met her, you could see she was a pretty tough cookie, but a really fair person to work with. She was in charge of a lot of the seamstresses on the floor, and she had quite a lot of responsibility. There was cases where the seamstresses, especially early on, you know, they learned as they went along when they were making these suits early on in the program. There were a lot of issues, a lot of problems. It's like inventing something and expecting it's going to come, you know, working 100% right out of the box, and it just didn't work that way. When these sewers were basting stitches together, they would take a straight needle, a straight pin, and hold the different piece parts together so they could run it under the sewing machine. And on occasion, they would leave one of those straight pins in the seam because they would miss it. They would forget it as they were going along. And so Ellie at one point found out that one of these pins were in the seam. And she scolded the seamstress and said, look, you've got to be careful with what you're doing. Well, this went on a couple more times. So finally, she just resorted to taking the pin, and she would go up behind the seamstress and jab her in the rear end with the pin.
Oh, goodness.
Hard. And people said that these seamstresses would scream out of the seats. And she said, now let that be a lesson. Don't ever let that happen again. But those are the kind of things that went on. But you know, these people had a schedule that was really phenomenal. They were working 10, 12 hour days, sometimes 7 days a week to meet these launch schedules. And the suits wouldn't just be built and then shipped out, and they wouldn't be seen again. These suits there were training suits that would get a lot of abuse. They would have to come back and get modified. Each mission would find something where they'd want to change something here or there. So these suits were constantly evolving. And so they might have built a suit where they had to change out the arms. Neil Armstrong's suit had his arms changed out completely just a month before the mission to put a new style arm on there, which really saved that mission because the older style was not very mobile. And so they had to take his suit and literally cut the arms off and restitch these arms back in. So, you know, these are things that had to happen within a day's period of time. So they were literally working around the clock to meet these schedules.
Wow. And, you know, you don't think of, or I don't think of these things because I don't sew much, but people who do realize a lot of sewing is also cutting patterns.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think about these seamstresses. Well, there are also these, you know, remarkable women that had to do this very precise cutting. Could you maybe talk about some of them or some of the yeah. people that stand out in your mind that were cutting these patterns that had to be so precise?
Yeah. And you don't appreciate it until you really see the detail of it. But there were so many layers of material within the suit. And one of the layers was this very thin aluminized mylar that was so thin and fragile. And what the cutters would do is the pattern makers would make patterns based on, you know, dimensions that would go together to make a torso that was a certain size. And all these parts had to come together when they were sewn to be just tailored perfectly. And then all the other layers that go with it had to be cut. So these pattern makers would lay the pattern, or the cutters would lay the patterns over it and mark this mylar ever so delicately, and then have to cut that by hand. And all those layers had to be done that way, and they couldn't make any mistakes. If they did, it was scrapped. So it was just very, very tedious work. And, you know, I'd like to talk about the patterns in the respect that, you know, you think about the rockets that were being built, the Saturns, the lunar modules, all the command module, all the hardware had mechanical drawings, and the machinists, everybody worked from these drawings, but you didn't have drawings for spacesuits. They had an overview drawing of what a suit would look like. But when you get down to putting a suit together, the patterns were actually the mechanical drawing for that suit. So the pattern itself was very critical and had to be done just perfectly. So these cutters were like the machinists that followed that pattern and had to do it precisely without missing within like sometimes a 32nd of an inch.
Wow. Well, you mentioned the layers, and I think now is a good time to talk about that. Let's go through the Apollo spacesuit, say the one that Neil Armstrong wore to walk on the moon, sure. and the astronauts through, say, Apollo 14, for example.
Yep.
Let's go through the layers from the skin out. So you start with this undergarment, and could you describe that to us?
Yeah, absolutely. So they wore like cotton underall type. You know, long pants and the shirt. But over that, there was liquid cooling garment. And that started with the chiffon layer that was a smooth, soft layer that acted as a protective layer between that and the tubes that were integrated into this spandex material. And the spandex, this liquid cooling garment that you would put on, was zippered up, and it was one piece. So you'd put your legs into it, arms into it, and then zip it up. And throughout that liquid cooling garment with 300 feet of 1/8 inch diameter tubing that pumped cold water through it from the primary life support system. So it would take cold water, take it through there, and pick up any body heat and carry it out of the suit and get cycled back in again as chilled water. So that was the initial garment that you put on before you put the spacesuit on. Then, of course, you put the spacesuit on, and then that consisted of the bladder layer, which is, think of like the inner tube of a tire, okay? Mm-hmm. All the oxygen in the suit and didn't allow any leakage to occur. Now, if you think about a tire in the inner tube, it would want to stretch if you just inflate it. It's like a balloon. So you have to, on the outside of that, your next layer is going to be your restraint layer. And they used a nylon material that was had very low elongation. It didn't stretch very, very much. And that's what you want. You want a lightweight, low stretch material that gives it the shape so that when you pressurize that suit, it's not going to expand on the wearer, because that suit is custom tailored to fit them perfectly. And if you put air pressure in it and let it expand out, then it's not going to fit you anymore. Your fingers are going to be out of the fingertips. Your feet are out of the boots of the suit. So that's critical. So when they were cutting the patterns for the bladder layer, those patterns were actually sized larger than the restraint layer that was in the outside. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because the bladder layer was taped together with cement and a cover tape so that it wouldn't leak. And then that was placed inside the restraint layer. So when it was pressurized, it didn't take any structural loading because the outer restraint layer was a little bit tighter. So that's your main pressure garment assembly. So that, and then we get into thermal micrometeorite garment. So, and that has all your outer layers, and those are responsible for protecting you from the radiation, heat transfer, the micrometeorite impacts that could strike at high velocity. And so all those work together. Now, there were a number of layers of aluminized mylar spaced with a spacer material. It was a non-woven material that acted as like a barrier that would keep the conduction through the layers from to a minimum, so it wouldn't conduct through. So, you know, I say roughly there's 23 layers in the suit, but it depends on what layer, what area of the suit you're looking at. Mm-hmm. Because then, of course, on the outside, there was a beta cloth, which is a woven fiberglass made by Owens Corning that, going back to what I said earlier, was the protection from the high temperatures of approximately 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. So they all work together. And on the outer layer, the beta cloth didn't take abrasion very well. If you abraded it, so if their elbows were rubbing against the couches or each other when they were in the command module, that created problems. So there were areas where you had a chrome LR, which is a chromium steel fabric that was sewn on into areas like the backpack, the gloves were chrome LR, so were the lunar boots, and that provided some abrasion resistance.
Wow. And if you were going to describe, like, what was the most complex layer of the spacesuit, what parts would that be?
I think the most complex part of any spacesuit, including Apollo, was the restraint layer. Because the restraint layer is what's taking all the pressure. So it not only has to hold the pressure. So if you lay a spacesuit out on a table and just inflate it with air, all that stress of that air pressure is going throughout the suit, and all those loads have to be carried properly. But then add a person in the suit, and let's say they're going to walk on the moon or jump on the moon or start using tools on the moon. Then you add what's called man loading or human loading factor, which is the muscle strength, the strength of the tools, the impact of tools, things of that nature that add to it. So that restraint layer with the cables, and in the book, I try to do it justice by getting the illustrations in there showing where all the cables are in that suit, which take the load, and that was the most complex, and I think in today's world it still is, because the spacesuit, whether you're going to the moon or Mars, no matter where you're going to work in a spacesuit, it has to have the pressure retention capability, and it has to take those loads and hold up, and yet not impose a lot of work on the astronaut inside that suit. They have to be able to work, bend the joints, and do all those things freely, as easily as possible. So it's by far, I think, in my opinion, it's restraint that is the hardest to make. And the gloves. The gloves are another part that's difficult.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned, you know, they have to be custom fitted for each astronaut. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, the role the astronauts actually played, you know, coming in to, you know, to be fitted? How often did they have to come in and for different refinements and things like that?
Yeah. So we had an area upstairs where the astronauts would come when they would fly their jets into Dover Air Force Base, and they would come out. We'd pick them up, bring them over to the plant, and they would go into this fitting room upstairs. And we would, prior to that, like months and maybe a year prior to that, we would take their dimensions. We took like just around 70 measurements of each astronaut. It would include their height, you know, all these different measurements. And that would determine the patterns that had to be made to fit the astronaut. So we'd build a suit based on those pattern sizes, all those dimensions we got from them, and the patterns were made from those dimensions. We build the suit, they would come to the plant, try it on, and we would make adjustments to it. Now, in the book, I talk about the fact that it's very difficult when you're working, when you're building spacesuits and you're trying to make the customer happy, it's a constant battle. If you're designing a capsule or a lunar module, you can have a consensus between all the astronauts where they want the switches, how they want it placed. There's probably, you know, I'm not a pilot, but I'm not used to that. That's not my expertise. But I think you can get a consensus of where they want their controls based on aerospace background, aircraft design, and those things. So that works fairly well. But when you get into spacesuits, you'll put an astronaut in the suit, and you might have there was one mission where we had the commander come in, and he tried a suit on, and he was in it, and he wanted the engineers to adjust the shoulders. They were hurting a little, but it was okay. They just needed an adjustment here and there. And the fit check went pretty fast. Within the hour, he was out of the suit so that they could make the adjustments. In the meantime, the lunar module pilot was to get in his suit. Now, when he got in his suit, one of the engineers who was there for the fit check said, now this was common too. It wasn't just this mission, but the lunar module pilot got in his suit and it went on and on about how something was pinching him here and there. The knee was hurting him, his waist. It was just biting him a little in the waist. Could you do something about that? And, oh gosh, my shoulder really hurts. If I go like this, it really bites me. Can you make this change here? And this went on for the longest time. And finally, the commander turned to the lunar module pilot and half jokingly said, if you don't sign off on this suit, after they make this change, just some the basic changes to this thing, if you don't do this, get it out of this suit soon, you're not flying on this mission with me. He's just getting annoyed. And it was just that way, you know. Now, to their credit, they wanted the suit to fit perfectly. And I certainly understand that. And that was what we were there to do, to get the suit to fit them. But it was just funny to see that, you know, someone were like, no, it's fine the way it is. Just make this adjustment. I'm good to go. And even after the debriefing, they loved their suits. And others just cried and cried about it. They just hated the fit. They just didn't like it. And so, but I get it. It was just, and of course, it was older technology too compared to today's suits. But it was very, very tough to get it totally right because of the nature of what we were making.
Yeah, it's not like me just going, hey, I just need a pair of 3830 jeans. Thanks.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is a life-critical garment. I mean, it had to fit right.
Yeah. And, we mentioned the liquid cooling layer. And, you know, I think it's good to mention that, you know, on the moon in the sunlight, you know, it was like 200 degrees. So, you know, it was, and plus they're doing hard exercise. They're working during these long moonwalks, these extravehicular activities. And sometimes for many hours. So, you know,
that's right.
getting that temperature just right. Could you tell us about like, how did they figure out, you know, how to get things just optimal to keep them like a thermostat, as it were, to keep them at the right temperature?
Sure. Well, you know, going back a little, looking at the history of the suit, during Gemini, Mercury, of course, they just sat in the capsule, didn't have to do anything other than sit there. So the capsule kept them comfortable. During Gemini, you have, Ed White, who goes out for just a float out there. Now, his Gemini suit, the David Clark suit, relied on airflow through the suit. And they really, at the time, thought that that would remove the BTUs of heat buildup from any activity in the suit. So as Ed White floated out there, he came back and in his debrief, he thought everything was pretty comfortable. But you have to keep in mind, Ed White just went out and floated for a little bit, 30 minutes, I think, give or take. And it wasn't long. He came back in. Everything worked great. On the other hand, a few missions later, there, Gene Cernan goes out, and he almost didn't make it back alive. He goes out of his spacecraft, the Gemini, to go back to the back end to do some experiments. There were no handholds to hold on to. At the time, I guess their thinking was he could maneuver his way back there and do what he had to do. But he really learned the hard way that you had to really work hard to make this suit work in space. And again, the Gemini suits didn't have the mobility that the Apollo suits ended up having. And so it was very difficult to work in these suits. He didn't have any handholds. It was just a tough mission. He sweat something terribly. He lost so much weight just in sweating in that short period of time. And so when he got back, everybody looked at it and said, yeah, this has got to, we've got to make a big improvement over this. And that, again, is what Gemini was all about, learning how to get to the moon. And the Royal Air Force had done some experimentation early on in the UK where they were looking at taking their pilots who were sitting on the runway under these hot canopies with the sun beating down, how to cool them down. So they came up with this idea of a garment that had tubes that flowed the cool water through. And so NASA took that and ran with it and turned it over to us eventually. Hamilton Standard did some work with it when we were subcontractors with them. And then when we won the contract, we were then responsible for developing this suit. And we didn't have to do a whole lot of work with it. It was pretty far along in the concept. We just had to make it work because, you know, there's a lot of thought that, you know, ILC kind of took ideas from other people. And so it was simple. But the problem was we had ideas, certainly. But when you put it into test, things didn't always work after you went through a profile of what a mission might be. And so we had to really work out all the details and the problems with these garments, including a liquid cooling garment, and figure out how to make this work optimally. And we did that, and it turned out that the cooling effect with the water, the way it works, the physics of it, it takes much more body heat out. And it did a great job. It just, that made a world of difference. So by the time we get to Apollo, any of the lunar missions, all the work they had to do, not only for the heat load from the sun, but to your point, what you said was more of it's contributed to the just the workload that they're under in this closed environment where they're sweating and just the water, the vapor has to be removed, all of that. And so they did a great job.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the making of the Apollo spacesuit with former International Latex Corporation test engineer and historian Bill Airy. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our visit with the author of the new book, Lunar Outfitters, Making the Apollo Spacesuit. Bill Airy has spent over 140 hours pressurized in spacesuits as a test engineer for the ILC, the International Latex Corporation, and he's an expert on the history of ILC's spacesuit manufacturing. There was another thing I found really fascinating in your book about, you know, you think about sewing machines, and you're working on this big bulky spacesuit. They had to make these like a couple of specialized giant sewing machines. Could you just kind of briefly describe that for us?
Yeah, sure. I found that interesting too when I was learning about it early on. They used even to this day. They're getting more modern machines now, but it wasn't up till too long ago. They used the standard Singer industrial sewing machines, which did a great job. And today they still use those type of machines. But for Apollo, the thermal micrometeorite garment layer, that big one piece garment there, and not so much the restraint layer, because they could put a lot of that together with the standard machines. But that outer layer really had to be put together as one garment, and they couldn't get it under the machines without really wrinkling things up and probably damaging the mylar underneath. So some industrial engineers at ILC got the smart idea of, hey, let's take one of the machines and just take the head of it and extend it out on a long arm. So they built this one machine, made it probably, I would say it's 3 feet out from the main body, maybe a little further, and from the post where it's anchored. So that allowed all the table space underneath so that the operators could move this TMG, thermal micrometeorite garment, under the needle and work with it. And they liked it so much, they ended up building a second one. So it was a big hit, and it really cut down on the production time and also the reject rate, and damage was cut down quite substantially.
Yeah, I found that really interesting. Another complicated part of any spacesuit, or anything really, when you think about it, is connections. Can you talk about like the difficulties with some of the connections involved in a spacesuit?
Yeah, sure. So you have to have the pass through of the suit. You don't want to break the pressure layer there. So, but yet you have to get your water in and out, your communications in and out, and you have to get the air to the oxygen itself in and out. So we had worked with a company called Airlock up in Connecticut, and we still do work with them today on this International Space Station suits. They're a very detailed company that does great work with machine metal pieces, such as the pass throughs for Apollo. So liquid cooling garment, the water had to go in and out, and there was a multiple water connector, and it had multiple pass-throughs in a one single connection. So when you made that single connection, the water would go in and out of that one connector. So that saved the astronauts the trouble of trying to fasten different connectors. And then your air in and out, of course, had to go through the connectors on the on the chest from the primary leg support system on the backpack. Today they do that. It's integrated into a fiberglass shell up top, and it's just put together so that it's a permanent setup. But during poly, I had these hoses that had to connect. So when you disconnected and connected, it was a shutoff in there because when they were in the lunar module, they were working off air from the oxygen from the lunar module. They would hook it into the suit, get everything up and running, put the backpacks on, and then they had to hook up the backpack connector and then disconnect the lunar connector. So there was this connection and disconnection going on. So they had all that to do. And I would add that there was water passed through in the helmet for liquid and also for food in case they had to keep their suits on for return to Earth, as in the case of Apollo 13. If they had lost pressure on board and they had to stay in their suits to the moon and back, the helmet provided a pass-through on the side that allowed food and water to be passed through that. So there was a number of things that had to be done. Also, there was an injection patch in the leg where they had to possibly, the doctors at NASA had a provision where they might have to inject a solution, probably for motion sickness. I'm not an expert on what it was, but there was a little rubber patch in there, silicone patch, that had to be kind of self-sealing. It had to be a soft durometer, meaning it was a soft material. They could put the needle through there and inject their thigh and pull it out, and it would seal. So wow. Those are challenges you face.
Oh, that's amazing. There was one picture that really stayed with me. It was Mrs. Iona Allen who sewed up Neil Armstrong's boots. And what that must have felt like for her to think about, those are the boots that I worked on that put that first footprint, that one small step for man. Well, what that must have felt like, what a moment for her.
Yeah, that didn't escape me. She passed away many years ago, but I still remember just talking with her and trying to and feeling that same emotion of like, well, Iona, that had to just be so, you know, it was mind-blowing to think that you worked on this boot and there you are months later watching this grainy image of Neil Armstrong walking down the ladder in the boot that you sewed together and stepping foot on the moon and making that famous statement, you know, one small step for man. And you were responsible for sewing that together. It's just, you know, and that was the boot, but it kind of carries through to all the seamstresses. Mm-hmm. I think those ladies that sewed those suits together, just imagine how they felt to see their work there on the moon, 275,000 miles away from Earth. It just had to be. And they told me that. And I just want to try to get that across in the story too.
Yeah. And you did. And you know, I would think also, you know, just from an engineering standpoint, from NASA management, anybody, you know, when you're watching like a moment when like Gene Cernan fell down during one of his EVAs and you're thinking, oh gosh, you know, I hope everything's okay in that spacesuit, because that's his, that's his life support system. And, and they held up just so remarkably well.
I did. I think it was Dave Scott. I might be wrong on that because it's been a few years ago now. But one of the astronauts, I was chatting with him about the suits, and they said, well, you know, they paused for a second and said, well, you know, if you look at those videos of us jumping around the moon, he said, I was falling down. I rolled over because he said, I was afraid if I fell on the backpack, that which was fiberglass shell. He said, I was more afraid that I'd crack something in that. He said, I had no concern for the suit. He said, I'd been in it enough times and I had the confidence in that suit. I wasn't worried about it. He said, it was kind of fun jumping around. He said, we weren't trying to fall, but he said, if I fell, I didn't have any concern that the suit was going to be damaged in any way. So he said, I would roll over intentionally and make sure I didn't land on the backpack, but just on the suit anywhere would be fine. So we just have plenty of confidence in that suit.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. Yeah. And then the suits do evolve. After Apollo 14, Alan Shepard's mission, which is we're coming up to the anniversary of that, and we'll be doing more on that soon. In February of 2021, the 50th anniversary of Apollo 14. But after that, the spacesuits evolve again. Can you tell us briefly about what were some of the changes that went on for the last generation of the lunar suits for Apollo 15 through 17?
Yeah, so as we were getting into the early Apollo missions, even before Apollo 11, our engineers knew that NASA wasn't totally pleased with mobility. It was okay. it didn't flex very well at the waist. And we knew that there'd be missions upcoming where they had to, well, for instance, sit in the lunar rover. So they had to have that flexibility in the waist. They needed them to be able to bend down and work with tools and all the things they had to do. So our engineers in 1968 had some funding from NASA to look at a next generation suit. So in 1968, we took a suit down to NASA headquarters down in Houston. And we put on a demonstration with that suit. It was called the Omega suit at the time. We didn't really have anything else to call it. It was called the Omega suit. There was Homer Reem said he came up with that. I'm not sure where it all started, but he says he takes claim for that name. It was just an experimental suit that had a much improved mobility. It had a better waist section because where you could bend at the waist. Because they relocated the zipper, which was a problem because the zipper can't leak. And so they had to move it, and it was a challenge. And I go into detail in the book about that. So that suit would ultimately become, and NASA liked it. NASA didn't like everything because we proposed a few other things and they weren't game on all of it, but they did really like the aspects of what we proposed. And so they funded us to make this new next generation suit. And because of all the qualification testing, you know, suits have to go through a lot of testing. There's design verification testing, there's certification testing, there's mission testing. All these things had to wring out all the problems with that suit before it could be used. And, you know, frankly, that's why the astronauts felt comfortable in it, because they knew all this testing happened ahead of time. So we came up with this new suit. It was then called the A7LB version. So there was the A7L and A7LB, meaning that it was a next generation suit. And the closest we could get that worked into the rotation was for Apollo 15. And so that's when that suit came into use and of course, used for the lunar rovers and it just provided much more mobility, and it turned out to be a good suit.
Yeah. And then let's talk about the future, because we're planning to go back to the moon with the Artemis program. Are you guys working on the next generation of moon suits?
Yes. Yeah, so I retired a little over a year ago. And when I left, I can speak for that. And then from what I gained over in that last year, we have a strong contingent of engineers down at Johnson Space Center. And they're geared primarily toward being at NASA's back door there to help them out. So I'm seeing speaking for myself, when I left, I could see NASA taking a big role in future suit development. They've been hiring a lot of new engineers that have come on. They're trying to train them, get them up to speed into what spacesuits are, teach them what they are, and look for this next generation suit. They still, though, turn frequently to us to help them in the manufacturing, designs, things of that nature. So we'll build parts and give it to them, and they incorporate them in, if not using our complete suit from some of the past future suit we've developed. So that's what NASA's up to right now. If you're NASA, of course, you do want the competition. You'd love it if you had five companies out there trying to design suits, but frankly, no one's going to open their business and they just start tomorrow designing spacesuits. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Before we let you go, I was thinking about all of the interesting stories we saw about Neil Armstrong's suit, which is at the National Air and Space Museum, that, you know, it's just such a historic thing. And then it was degrading because of the different latex materials in it. Could you tell us just very briefly about the restoration of that suit?
Yeah, sure. Certainly. That's been a lot of fun for me going over there and helping such great people over there at the National Air and Space Museum, Kathy Lewis and Lisa Young. And there's a host of folks they have over there. They're conservators that really do a great job preserving these suits. Sadly, you know, these suits, the early suits, I say early up to Apollo 14, the A7L suits were built with a rubber that, had a shelf life of 6 months, could last a year. And after a few years, it was probably still supple enough you could pressurize the suits and they'd hold air. But as time's going on, it's rubber. So the rubber's degrading. It's like I tell people, take a rubber band out and put it out in the sun, like on a hot car, and let it sit there for a week and try to see what kind of shape that rubber band's in. They generally fall apart unless they're really made out of, you know, conditioned real well with the materials in it. But that was rubber, and that's what it did. But it was fine for Apollo. It got each astronaut through a mission. They got back and went to the Smithsonian. So after all these years now, You take Neil Armstrong's suit. I've gone over there and worked with him on the suit. I've been around the suit several times. And when you gently turn it over, you work with the suit very gently. And when you do, you literally see dust particles falling out of it, this black sooty dust-like material. And it's the rubber that's just totally degraded in the suit. And so their mission is to get the suit in an environment where it's within a certain temperature range and humidity range. You don't want it too cold. You don't want it warm. UV light, you have to keep off of it, of course. But the degradation inside is going to continue on. There's really nothing much you can do about that. So their goal is to maintain the outer layers, which they can do. The support of the suit has to be such that it's not stretching. The arms aren't pulling it down. So they're very smart in how they do that. And so I think they can preserve the suit for many, many years to come as far as what you see on the outside. Sadly, on the inside, it's probably going to still degrade. The suits from Apollo 15 on, we used a material called age-right white, which was an antioxidant in the rubber, which to this day, not too many years ago, I was actually pressurized in Gene Cernan's training suit that he had, or backup suit, that NASA still had, and they shipped it up to ILC, and I was fortunate enough to get in it. And we actually pressurized that suit, and it still holds air.
Wow. Because
the rubber used that age-right white, and it's still holding up today. And the Smithsonian has some of those suits, and I bet you in the condition they're keeping them, they're probably going to hold up for a number of years.
That's amazing. Well, we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us to talk about your amazing work with ILC and this great book, Lunar Outfitters, Making the Apollo Spacesuit. So, Bill, thank you for sharing your expertise and the amazing story of these little miniature spacecraft, the suits that the astronauts wore on the moon.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's been my honor to be with you.
Thanks once again to our guest, Bill Airy. His book, Lunar Outfitters Making the Apollo Spacesuit, is available from most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.